Hello and welcome back to a new season of Cycling Mo, your cycling informant. I am delighted to be once again joined by Matthew Jorgensen of, well, still of Movistar, soon to be of Jumbo Visma or Visma Lisa Bike, depending on which name they go for. Matthew, thank you for joining us. How are we in a sunny California?
Super good. I'm super good. Thanks for having me again. This is turning into a bit of a tradition.
Our yearly review of your season.
Exactly.
So let's kick off with a question. So today I have spent my whole day looking back at every race you've done this season and also looking back at previous years. So 2021, eighth in Paris-Nice, second in the Edinburgh stage. I saw you of Tour of Britain.
Yeah.
2022, yep. Fifth in Provence, three top fives at the Tour de France. You started this year. What type of rider? I don't mean classics. I don't mean mountain rider. What type of rider would you have referred to yourself as? A promising talent, somebody with much to prove. How do you think you started the year?
Yeah, I definitely felt like I had quite a bit to prove. I had never won a race before, so I think until you win a bike race, I think it's hard to really have any kind of expectation for a result at a big race. But that was my main kind of focus, was to try to get my first win, because I felt like I needed to do that, and I needed to kind of get that confidence and just kind of prove to myself that I can do it. So that was my main goal. And I did feel like I needed to, yeah, I felt like I had a lot to prove for sure before the year started.
Okay, so you start off in Oman, and I remember talking to you before the race, and I can honestly say I think it's the most confident I've ever heard you speak. You came in feeling super strong, super confident. You get the first pro win, stage three, Jebel Hat, where you were quite clearly the strongest rider that day by a considerable distance. So, easy question. How did it feel to get that first pro win?
Yeah, amazing. I mean, really, that was probably the most emotion I've ever had in a bike race, or yeah, for a long time. It felt really good. I've never really had that kind of a feeling before, so it was cool. And also, just I felt like that winter I'd really, for whatever reason, put a lot of pressure on myself to like have a really good winter and be ready for those first races. I usually come out in the first races really good, so I felt like I wanted to kind of just see if I could get that win off the plate early, because I think I know it helped me then afterwards with the bigger races afterwards. So yeah, it was really important that I did that, and it was awesome. It was just a great race. I was super happy with how Oman went, and it was just a cool way to start the season.
That particular stage, the team did a great job. I think particularly Gonzalez did a very, very good job on the final climb. And the final climb is 4.6K at 7.7%. You attacked once, I think, inside the final K. You were covered, and then you waited. But for those who were watching, you could see you were the strongest. Did it feel like that in the moment? Did you feel like you were the strongest?
You know, yeah. I actually think that was the only time I maybe ever had that in a bike race. Still, like afterwards, I never had that either in another race. But it was like the only time where I remember Abner, yeah, brought me up with a little over a K to go, and he pulled off with a K to go. And I kind of just put in a move there because it was the steepest section, and I kind of wanted to see, first of all, who would follow and if we could just get some separation. And kind of thin the group out a little bit. And so I remember attacking and looking back, and I remember just getting the feeling that a lot of guys were on the limit when I felt still quite good. And that was probably the only time I've ever had that type of feeling. Like, really, it was a pretty special pretty special feeling. And yeah, from then on, I kind of knew that I just had to be smart and wait as long as I could, because I think I felt like I had the most left in the tank. So I just kind of tried to just wait until the final kick from there. And thankfully, no one else was kind of bluffing or had more in the tank.
Then you go to Green Mountain, final stage, 5K, 10%, or it's close to that, I think. And it's just a, from watching, it looks a horrible, horrible effort. You finish second on the stage, just behind Van Seven, and you win GC by 1 second. But given the gradient, it never looked easy. From watching on TV, how did it feel?
Yeah, that was a heinous climb, to be honest. It was like the type of thing where the road is so wide there, and it was so hot, and yeah, it was just felt like you weren't moving at all the whole climb, and yet we were doing like 500 watts the whole climb, and it was just, yeah, it's like the type of climb where you never feel confident about it, because from the bottom, it's like I think Intermarché had a plan to just like go completely full. And I think the first 10 minutes were harder than the second 10 minutes, you know. So it was like we all went completely into the red in the first 10 minutes because that's the pace they said. And then a bunch of guys ended up pulling off and there just wasn't anybody left. So we kind of ended up in the final K or so, kind of sitting up and looking around. But I remember just being pretty not confident about it after like the first 10 minutes because you're just so on the limit. But, it turned out that everyone was, and thankfully the gradient, it was the first time also that I needed to prove myself on such a gradient because I'm just a big guy, and I remember being pretty nervous about it because it's just really not advantageous for me to be on over 10% like that. But yeah, I think I was just in really good form then, and it worked out to be that I had the best legs that day. So Mari obviously had better legs, but I mean, in that race, I was just in really good form at that race.
It's a funny climb because normally you would expect it to be a climber's climb, 5K, 10%, but every year it never really works out that way. I think it's because
Yeah.
where it is in the season, guys are coming in with different objectives. Yeah, it always seems to throw up a su surprise. Like Lysenko's won twice up there. It's not a climber's climb, is it? It's
No, I think it's because, well, there's a few reasons. It's because there's no other climbs that stage at all. So you end up, everyone comes into it completely fresh. And then also the climb is like, it's 3 steps. So it's like a really hard, 7 minutes and then like a minute flat, even down. There was a little downhill and then another steep section and then a little flat and then the last kick. So it ends up being kind of explosive in the way that it's like, the power profile is not flat at all. You have like huge peaks, and then you have, I think I had like 50 seconds of almost coasting on the downhill in the middle of the climb. So it ends up being really explosive and not really for the pure climbers.
almost like one of those weird training efforts where you're going full gas for 7 minutes, then rest, then in full gas. Yeah.
Exactly. It just is a weird effort in that way, but I think it worked out for me, thankfully.
Yeah. So great start to the season. You get your first win. You get your second win because you win GC. So then you head opening weekend. You finish in the main group behind Van Baarle and Omloop. And then we head to Paris-Nice. Oman is important. It's a big race, but it's not World Tour. I don't want to sound dismissive of it here, but it's not in Europe. And for most riders,
Yeah.
this is where they want to perform. So you head to Paris-Nice. There's Pogacar, there's Vingegaard, there's Godu, Simon Yates, lots of top riders. And you go in there and you finish eighth on GC, which could have been more. I want to just talk about the final stage, which was your best performance in the race, where you seemed to be super, super strong. Did my research. I think it was the third time you did Paris-Nice. It's the first time you ever did the Nice stage. You
Yeah.
stay there. What was that day like?
Yeah, that day is a ride in Nice that we do all the time. So it's like I've probably done that that route like, I don't know, almost 100 times. But it's, you're right, the first time I've ever raced it, because in 2020, when I did the race with COVID, or maybe it was 2021, they ended up canceling the last day and putting us on a circuit outside of the city because they were worried about, yeah, fans and COVID, and it was like a city regulation that they couldn't have events in the city. So it was the first time I'd raced that, and I was pretty, I've always thought that's like one of the best bike races of the year. I still think it is. It's like the route and the way that it's the last day of the week, everyone's a bit tired, and you have like a mix of guys trying to fight for GC and then guys who have lost time, and it's such a dynamic route with like no flat, really technical downhills, short climbs. It makes it like really open for a lot of different riders. So I've always really loved watching that race, and so I'm just hyped to race that day. And you're right, that was the best, my best performance in Paris-Nice this year. It was that last day, and it went super well. I wanted, you know, that day was kind of my day to make up time in GC, and that was my whole plan going in. So I was trying to the whole day just stay patient, because there were tons of opportunities to go with like pulls or the early break or whatever to try to move up. But I knew that it was all going to come together before the last time up Col d'Huez, and it's a super steep routing they took us this year. It's not the traditional Col d'Huez, so it's a pretty decisive one, and only kind of the, yeah, it usually would come together by then. You shouldn't expend energy before, so it almost all worked out, and I almost kind of leapfrogged up the GC, but it just, our group didn't work super well together. Once I was with Vingegaard and Yates and Godu, we just, you know, it's understandable because they had their GC places set, and there was no reason for them to try to ride hard at all. Like Pogačar was up the road pretty unattainable, at an unattainable distance. He was like a minute, he got a minute pretty like within, I don't know, a kilometer or so of attacking. He had like a minute gap, so it just was kind of a stagnant group that I was in, and it just didn't work out. I think I finished on like the same time as Bardet, and yeah, I didn't move up any places at all, but which was a little disappointing, honestly. I did feel like it was a good performance that I had that day, but I really wanted to, because I'd finished eighth in Paris-Nice before, so I wanted to try to get to fifth. And yeah, it doesn't mean much now looking back, but in the moment I was actually pretty disappointed, and yeah, it would have been nice to kind of improve on that result a little bit, but didn't work out.
Because you were fifth on the road for a lot of the descent back into to Nice or back down to the prom. But as you said, it was unfortunate that in your group was second, third, fourth on GC, and nobody, there was no reason to go.
Exactly.
And the group behind are
No.
chasing for their lives, so.
And I think behind they had Jack Haig. Somebody had a teammate behind. I think, yeah, somebody had a teammate behind. So they were really flying behind, and we just couldn't make up any ground. It was also like I was just in a group of small guys. I realized, like, once we got on the descent, I realized how small the guys I was with were. It was like I was seeing over their heads by quite a bit on the descent. So yeah, it didn't work out.
Question about Pogacar. So you're there on Col d'Huez when he attacks, and you mentioned he got a massive gap quite quickly. What does it feel like to see that type of attack and see him put in so much distance in such a short space of time? Is it demoralizing? Is it motivating to, like, I want to get to a better level? What does it feel like?
Yeah, it was pretty demoralizing for all of us. Like, you know, I think all those guys kind of had maybe an idea going into the stage to like, you know, think about trying to move up, or at least their team probably had a plan to try to win the race on that last climb. And just seeing how easily he rode away from us was pretty demoralizing, which also added to their kind of lack of pushing in the group. But yeah, I don't think it doesn't really motivate me much. It's just kind of a, yeah, it was just a clear difference in level at that point of how much better he was on that day. But it's pretty understandable. He's probably the best rider in the world, so.
Not according to the people who give out the awards, he's not.
That's true. That's true. I'm not going to argue with that. I'm not going to argue with that.
We're not going to get into that debate. So then you head to
Good.
Belgium and you go and you make your debut at E3 and at Tour of Flanders. So E3, you finish fourth, which was a absolutely fantastic result. Now, in our previous chats, I have one who has long been looking for you to be a classics rider. Your managers at Movistar have thought that you were going to become a stage race rider, and maybe your second place in Romandy proves them right as well. What was your debut E3 like?
Really good. Yeah, it's weird because it's like one of those races, I think E3, where it's I think it depend I think a lot of it is how well you know the roads there. I think all the classics are, but especially E3, after pre-riding it, I kind of realized how important the recon is and how important, like, it's just a pretty technical, like, middle part with all the climbs and where it splits up. It's like you kind of need to know where you're going and know where you are and what's coming up. And I just didn't have that at all. So I kind of leaned on Johan beforehand in the recon, explaining it to me and stuff. And then also Chente, who's in the car, you know, knows all these classics super well. And both of those things helped. But I think, to be honest, that was probably my best. That was probably the day where I had the best legs of the year. It was like, obviously there were much better riders than were in Oman, but I think I had much better legs that day than I even did in Oman or that last day in Pyrenees. Yeah, I just kind of basically made up places based on legs a lot of times. Like I went solo in a pretty bad place. They
I was
caught
going
me
to ask
from
about
behind.
that. I wanted to ask about that. So you go solo, nobody goes with you. How did that feel?
Well, it's like, yeah, pretty bad. I won't lie to you. It was a period in the race where it was like all the helpers were attacked, or all like the, you know, second tier guys on all the teams were attacking to try to kind of anticipate when the big guys would move. So it was like, it felt like the right time to attack. I think like Soren Krau had just been caught. With Van Hooijdonk, maybe, like, those guys were out and then they had just gotten caught, and it was right after a big move up the Tijnberg, I think, from Vanderpool. And so I felt like a great time to go, and I think it was, but yeah, nobody ended up following me because I think I counterattacked a move with like the guys that I was trying to go with. So yeah, it just didn't really make sense. And then what's funny is that as soon as I got caught, then I think Soren Krau went over the top of me and he brought Van Hooijdonk and a few other guys up the road. So it's like, yeah, I just got played. But yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think I made a lot of wrong decisions in that race. Also, when the you know, final move went on that, I forget what that sector is called. That's kind of flat. You go over the train tracks where Van Baarle
Stationsberg,
crashed.
I think it is.
Stationsberg. Yeah, that sector was like pretty key, and that's where those big guys went, and I was just in terrible position going into that. And I remember being like super far back and having to like fight, you know, up gap. It was like kind of crosswind, and I remember having to close gaps myself through groups. And by the time I made it into kind of like the second group on the road, those three guys were or three or four guys were completely gone. So yeah, I kind of was just doing a lot of dumb things, maybe, but it was just a insane. Yeah, I just had insane legs that day. And then even in the final, once we got through all the sectors, I just found myself having like more and more energy, and yeah, I was able to kind of keep attacking. I eventually went with Kung, and we were kind of like, yeah, just working in the crosswinds and getting like splitting our group up. And then my attack at the end was also super. I just felt great the whole day. I just felt like, you know, I could keep attacking, and mentally I had clarity, and I was never really fully on the limit, which is something that I'm not super familiar with in those kind of races. So yeah, it just kind of, that fourth was out of just legs, which is yeah, interesting. I need to kind of probably analyze my run into that race for next year and see if I can kind of repeat that because I just had insane legs that day.
So that was 204 kilometers. The following week, you go to your debut in the Tour of Flanders, 273.4 kilometers, ninth on debut, which was again a fantastic result. You managed to get into the really surprisingly large breakaway, well, later breakaway, with lots of dangerous riders. And for a moment, well, for probably more than one moment, it looked like the peloton had made a mistake, letting riders like yourself, Pedersen, get up the road. When the gap hit kind of 3 minutes, were you thinking there was a chance to play out for the win?
No. I knew in that race. I think the way that we raced it this year was so on from like the start. I mean, I remember in the first hour, Vanderpool was like 3 minutes back at a certain point. He had gotten split in the crosswind from the start when the break was going, and it was just, I mean, it was just pure chaos the whole day. And then we had that obviously famous huge crash that I was in with the Bahrain guy, and I had to come back after that, but I was coming back with, huge name rider. So yeah, it was just kind of chaos all day. And so once that group went and I was in there, we were all pretty dead. Like we did get 3 minutes at a certain point, but it was just because back in the group, like, well, first of all, every team was represented in that break, or every big team. So we were all just kind of riding up the road, not super hard. We were just kind of rolling through, but it was mainly just the group behind was just sitting up because nobody was riding, and everyone was pretty happy to let that group go. So it felt like we were kind of given those 3 minutes, and we were all pretty dead, to be honest. Like looking around that group, like we were all on our last legs going up those final climbs, especially like the Koppenberg. I remember being pretty, I'd never raced up the Koppenberg in a race, so I was actually pretty worried about, even that day it was wet, so I was pretty worried about making it up at all, like on the bike, and not walking. And I remember we all kind of like fought to get in the sector, and we barely made it up, all of us, but nobody got any gap at all. And so I realized that we were all just completely dead. And so once I heard that they started attacking behind, like Vanderpool and Pogacar, I knew that it was going to be pretty quick that they would catch. And then if they caught us before any, even if they caught us right at the bottom of the final Paterberg, it would have been enough to probably get separation on all of us just because of how dead we were. So I never expected that we'd have a chance to fight for the win. No, not at all.
So the length of the race obviously is your first Flanders. Is there anything you can compare the feeling to, the dead feeling, the horrible feeling of last time up the Quarmont Paterberg? Is there anything that compares to that you've ever done before?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, the only thing that compares is going up Rochefoucauld in Liège, the last climb in Liège. I mean, that's the only thing that compares. But the difference is, I think in Liège, it's like it's not cobbled, so the climb, like, it doesn't force you to go hard to get up it. It doesn't have like the same, like, there's a thing in Flanders, you're dead, but you still have to get up the climb, and you're trying to stay in the group, and it's so like brutally, it's such a musk, it's like it hurts so bad muscularly because it's so bumpy and it's so steep that it's like you have a muscular pain that you just don't get in Liège. So it's comparable, but no, there's not really a feeling that I think comes close to
Looking forward to next
that. Yeah, looking forward to
year.
it.
So then you have a small break, and then we're off to Tour de Romandie, a very mountainous race, world tour race in Europe. You put in an amazing performance in the time trial. You finished second behind Ayuso by, I think it was about 5 seconds. Ayuso, who was going downhill like a stone. I think that's probably where he won it.
Yeah.
Then you go to Thion 2000, where you eventually lose the GC race to Adam Yates, but put in what I think is probably your best performance in a mountain stage ever.
Yeah,
What
for
was
sure.
that? What was that climb like?
I have some regrets about that climb, to be honest with you. I mean, it was, you're right, it was definitely my best mountain performance ever. It's my best performance on that long of a climb. It's like the only time that I've ever really tested myself on an hour long climb, I think, in a race. So, I'm definitely still happy with how I rode. And but I do think that there was that moment where it was a bit strange because Ayuso was dropped for there was a maybe 10 minutes where Ayuso was dropped and Yates didn't have the green light to attack. So everyone was kind of sitting up, and I didn't really fully realize that I at that point was the virtual leader. I was mainly focused. I kind of knew from the beginning that Yates was the guy that they were riding for, like the bet he had the best chance to win the race. So I was super focused on Yates, and there was a moment where Ayuso was dropped and nobody was riding, and we all kind of sat up, and Yates was at the back of the group, like asking on the, like everyone could hear him, like it was just complete silence, and he was asking on the radio, like, "Can I attack? Can I attack?" And in that moment, it was like I should have just kind of gone and put like a little bit of pace. I should have just ridden the front for like 10 minutes at a good pace and made it harder to like make a change in pace, because I think at that point we had gone so easy for like 3 to 5 minutes that I mean, it wasn't like super easy, but we were definitely not like we were not going hard for a while. And then Yates came from the back and attacked like a few times and kind of just like was attack that just like rode me off the wheel. It was like he had enough left in the tank to like go into VO2 and actually just ride. I couldn't like follow the pace at that moment. And I think if I had just set tempo and like just ridden threshold until like the final couple kilometers, I maybe could have, you know, saved myself I maybe could have kept that group together essentially and made it harder for him to attack, and then made the gaps a lot smaller once they could get away from me in the final K or two. So that was my kind of one regret. But overall, I think, you know, the best guy won on the day, but for sure. It's just tactically, I maybe could have played it a little better. And yeah, I think that's something to learn from in the future, because I'm the type of guy where I'm so big that I just need to have a steady pace on a climb like that. And it would have really helped if I just put my own threshold and just ridden it all the way up to the finish, because it was so steep on that climb also that they're barely benefiting on the wheel. So it just would have been a much smarter thing to do, I think.
Because that's the thing, you are what like 6'2", 6'3".
Yeah, I'm 6 foot 3. Yeah,
Yates is like a jockey who rides horses, you
like 3 foot 1, I think.
So like it was funny. I was when I was watching it, I'm looking at it, and you developed what can only be described as the Vietnam stare as you were trying to close back in on Yates. Face white, like just in some zone of
Yeah.
absolute pain. And it reminded
Right.
me, and this is going to really make your head big, it reminded me of like an injury, and it reminded me of, I'm not sure if I can even mention his name anymore, like Voldemort. It reminded me of a Lance Armstrong, that because maybe more like injury, and because you are so tall, like that, just that
Right.
tempo. I need to ride at a tempo. I can't react to
Right.
these tiny little guys doing these big attacks. But for me,
Exactly.
I know you're saying you would maybe do it slightly differently. I think you're being probably a little bit harsh on yourself. I think that was like one hell of a performance that day.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. I mean, I think you're right. Looking at the numbers afterwards, it was like my best 60-minute power ever in a race or not. And we actually had raced very, very hard that day on all the climbs. So it was also a huge day. I think it was like over 4,000 meters, and it was by far the best I've ever performed on a day that big. So no, you're totally right. I think I can be happy with that whole performance. Also, looking back, it's funny you say that. I remember watching it again a few weeks later, and seeing how my face looked. And then when they would switch back to Yates, he just looked like he was like riding a city bike around the city. You know, it just was like such a contrast of style that I just was, it's like embarrassing to watch that, because it's like, wow, that guy was so comfortable. It's great. He also looks like that no matter what I think, but it's a pretty funny contrast that day.
I remember talking to Sepkus maybe a couple of years ago. Yates must have won Catalonia maybe 2021 or something, riding for Ineos, and he attacked away from Sepp on one of the climbs, and Sepp isn't a big guy, and he just described him. I think he said something along the lines of, "It's very hard to keep pace with a jockey of the size of Adam Yates," which I think is probably true for somebody who's also 6'2", 6'3", like yourself. We'll see. Okay, so then we head.
Yeah, for sure.
Then it's break off the bike, time to reset. Probably, I don't know. I'm going to suggest maybe altitude camp, and before you head to Dauphiné, where you're there primarily to ride for Enric Mas, but then you crash. I think, was it stage three that you crashed?
I don't know. I don't remember what stage. It
Day before
sounds
the
like it could
TT, was
be.
it?
It was the stage where, yeah, exactly. It was the day before the TT. It was the stage where no break went, and I crashed twice actually. And I went down in two separate crashes. It was like one of those days where the break never went, and it was just heinously nervous, and everyone was crashing left and right. But yeah, that was a bad day.
And what injuries did you get?
I was just bruised up everywhere. And I kind of was strained in my, I think I hit my glute really hard and was just like my muscularly very taxed. I just like went down once on either side. So I had both hips with road rash. And yeah, I just was not in a good way after that, or before that. I mean, I just wasn't even in good form in Dauphiné. We made some mistakes with the break after Romandie, and then how hard we pushed at altitude, and I just never felt good in Dauphiné at all. But that crash just made it 10 times worse. I just never came back out of it after that.
And then, did that affect your prep for the Tour de France as well?
Yeah, I just we like I said, we made some mistakes in the altitude camp before Dauphiné and Tour, that it just, I had such a load on my body that I just never was able to kind of shed the fatigue. And yeah, between Dauphiné and Tour, I went back to an altitude hotel, and we kind of tried to solve some of the issues by taking it easier and really just focusing on recovery. But yeah, the blood tests I was having and the markers of inflammation and fatigue were all just super high. And it's like when you're about to do the Tour de France, you can't just take, fully a week off after Dauphiné. You can't just completely shut it down, because you'll just be way too fresh and bad at the tour. And especially when I didn't have, there weren't any expectations on me for the tour. I was there to be a helper and just be there for a specific role and be a diesel. So it really wasn't a big deal if I was going to be kind of dieseled out and not able to handle the big acceleration. So we kind of just I kind of maintained between the two races. And yeah, I didn't enter the tour in a good place either. It was pretty average. But yeah, it's what we had. It's kind of, we had to race with what I had at that moment.
So you're heading into the tour not at your best, and then Enric crashes out stage one. That
Yeah.
must have been not a great moment for you personally, Enric, or the team.
No, not at all. That was really a shock for the whole team. It was just pretty disappointing. I think the team really had gambled on Enric being, yeah, they just put a lot of their cards on the table with the selection of the team, to have the leader really be clearly Enric, and all of us had specific kind of roles to be there for him. And so it just made it really hard to shift us. We had a lot of guys that would have been really good in a supporting role. Like we could have all done our jobs, I think, to a really good degree, but then shifting that to trying to win stages out of breakaways, it just didn't work out for us. We had a hard time, even getting in a lot of the breakaways. A lot of guys, I think some of the guys didn't even make a breakaway the whole tour, for whatever reason. It was just a really Yeah, it kind of just drained the morale out of the team. Also, we had a pretty lackluster group dynamic from then on because, yeah, I mean, directors started leaving the race, and we kind of like the staff kind of dwindled after that, and they started pulling out resources. So it's just kind of yeah, it was just an unfortunate series of events, really.
But you personally made three breakaways, all of which went the full distance. First of all was the Stage de Lorraine that Jai Hindley won, where you were.
Yeah, he made it the full distance. The rest of us not so much.
Fair point, fair point. That was obviously crazy day to make the break. Just for me, watching one of the craziest Tour de France stages in the last few years, and there's been quite a few. Then we go to Puy-de-Dôme, and it is the total opposite. So we always talk about breakaways taking like an hour to form, and you've got to carefully manage your resources. And some guys wait for like 40K before they do anything. And Puy-de-Dôme, the breakaway goes just like that, straight from the front. Done, and you managed to get, and I think you were actually one of the last. You jumped across, didn't you?
I didn't jump across, but I was one of the last guys to do it because you're totally right. That was such a strange thing. But I realized it was happening when it was happening because it was one of those moments where like the break is going and you can tell the guys just behind everyone that was going in the break was, like sitting up and trying to make a wall. And I was one of the last guys to kind of like be in the wall. And I already had Gorka that we already had Gorka in the move. And so I had a moment of hesitation where I was like, well, we already have Gorka there. And so it was like, do I go and risk bringing everyone with me to close this? And I ended up someone, I think Latour went, and I just like Latour went up the right, and I just like barely saw him out of the corner of my eye and jumped on his wheel. And thankfully someone right behind me closed the wall again. And we were the last two to make it in the group. And I just remember being like, it was surreal because like you just said, every other breakaway I've ever been in the Tour de France, it's taken like 90 minutes for it to form, right? And it's been like complete, like you destroy yourself to get there. And that day was just like, we got there and we just started rotating and we're all looking at each other like, this is it? Like, we were all dumbfounded by the thought of how we just made it. But it ended up making the whole day. It's pretty strange, right? Because then we got such a big gap because behind they just didn't care at all. So we got like, I think we got like 15 minutes at a certain point. And we had that with so far left to go in the day that it was like, what do we do now? Right? It's like, first of all, why are we still rotating through? Nobody had any reason to keep pulling or keep pushing. And so once you start sitting up and everyone's looking at each other, it never really happened, but everyone kind of felt like we just needed to keep rolling through to keep kind of the everyone happy for a while, because if we started attacking at 100K to go, it would just be pointless. But eventually it was kind of a weird thing where somebody let the wheel go from Boivin, the Canadian guy, and he just kind of went on a descent without even trying to go. And that just kicked off the festival of everyone, punching each other. And yeah, it was way too early to go, but we all kind of just started doing it, and it felt like a pretty weird scenario, but
And it was a strange dynamic because quite a few of you had teammates in the group. You obviously had Michael
yeah.
Reid there, who was a favourite for the finish because it was so super steep. So the various attacks go. It's a super strong group. Mohoric is there, Paulus is there, Woods is there, Burgodo, who was having a tremendous race, was there, De La Cruz. And then you go, I think it was 47 kilometers, and you go solo. and then you get quite a good gap, and then Mohoric, Paulus, Burgodo, De La Cruz then manage to get away maybe another 10K after, and they get to about 18 seconds, and I'm watching thinking you're going to sit up. You can see these guys coming, you're going to sit up. That doesn't happen, and they never catch you. Like, what was the story with that? Were you just like, I'm not waiting, I'm just going to keep going?
Yeah, unlike E3, that day I actually knew that I wanted to be solo. So I actually had the idea in my head. I'd already talked with Chente that day. Like I dropped back to the car and we were talking. And we kind of both agreed that the best scenario would be to get in either a group with like one other guy who was clearly not as good of a climber, or, in theory shouldn't be as good of a climber, or be solo, because in a group that big and with so much time on our hands, it felt like the type of day where enough guys could sit up and to where, some guys could screw it up. It could have been a day where they let a group go and then they get too much time and they won. So I kind of knew in that attacking phase that I wanted to try to find a moment to go solo. And once I actually was solo, I didn't want any group to catch me because I'd already invested so much energy into it that, let's say, I was already probably solo for 25K by the time Mohoric and Paulus and Burgodo got close to me, and I knew they were super close. And it was like at that point, if they had caught me, I knew Nielsen and Mohoric would outclimb me because they had been back there in a group for an hour while I was solo, and it just wasn't I just knew that I had to go all in to the solo at that point. So I was trying to resist being caught for sure. I was playing with the time caps, and as I got closer, I would push way harder. And then I knew I just had to make it to that descent into Clermont-Ferrand solo because, when you're solo, you can descend a lot of times much faster. And we had also recon that whole stage and that descent super well. So I actually knew it, and I just knew that I need to make it to the. To we had kind of a bottle point set up right before the downhill, so I knew that if I could get to that bottle and get it before the descent solo, then it would probably work out and I could gain some more time back, which it all worked out pretty well.
So start of the climb, you are, I think you were a minute clear of the chasing group. You were 1 minute 45 clear of the next group behind. And then you managed to actually increase the lead. And then when you start the bit with the tram track, the final 3K, it like probably felt like 20% for you. you've got a bigger gap. Very strangely, I don't know if you've watched it back. Victor Campenaerts was leading the Michael Woods group. There is a vicious rumor going around that there was maybe a favor being paid for there, but we'll never know. And you go all the way. You are there, and then Woods is chasing. And like I know you, like I'm cheering you on. And I think everybody watching that stage is cheering you on because they can see Woods chasing you, they can see him catching you, and he gets there at 500 meters to go. And like, I think everybody who wanted you to win that day felt so deflated. Like, how did you feel? Like at that point, just how terrible is it when the catch is made?
It was a pretty surreal. That whole climb was surreal in a lot of ways, just because of the whole dynamic of fans and how once we got to the hardest part of the climb, nobody was there. And we also they stopped all the cars at the bottom, so we didn't have any radio. Like we kind of went around the mountain, and we didn't even have radio contact. So the only thing I had was the moto there with, chalk, like writing some chalk numbers. And it was totally surreal because you're so in your own head that whole way. You're like, I also was really empty. Like I just had obviously done an hour at threshold or barely below threshold, and I just had nothing left. At that point I was pushing like really low power. I was just completely on my last legs, like trying to get up the climb, and there was really nothing more I could do. Like I couldn't pace it or anything. I just like was going as hard as I could go. Like there was no like, but you're so in your own head, like, you know, wondering where they are, wondering who's coming. And I actually never even thought about Woods because he wasn't ever on the chalkboard. They would always just put Mohorič, and Mohorič was the only reference. And so I was just thinking, okay, Mohorič is going to catch me. He's paced it perfectly all day. And, you know, you make up these stories in your head about like, he's clearly done everything perfect. He was sitting back there waiting for this to happen. And that's the dynamic that I had in my head. And so I'm just thinking, oh, he's going to come by me like in the last 50 meters. And then I just literally, before I know it, I just hear Woods, and he's like literally shifting behind me. And I look back and he's there. And it was like such a shock. And you're right, like such a, I think I probably had the same emotion as everyone watching, was just like complete deflation. It was mostly just like disillusionment. You know, you just kind of lose the whole, because for an hour I'd been telling myself like it felt so unlikely that I could make it, like the entire hour. And I was just sitting there kind of like convincing myself that it could work. And you're just kind of like pushing your own head to kind of like convince yourself to make it work. And so when he was there and he came past me obviously easily, and at that point I just like completely stopped pedaling. You know, I was like, I didn't even care if I, yeah, I just wanted to get across the finish and stop pedaling. You know, I just stopped pushing because it just didn't matter anymore. And yeah, it was a pretty, after that also I was pretty deflated for a while. It took me, yeah, a long time, the whole rest day, to kind of come out of that disappointment, because it just felt like also I had put in so much that day. Like it was such a big effort to recover from. Like I'd spent, you know, 90 minutes at threshold basically, like at the end of a stage. It was such a hot day, and I knew that it was going to basically have an effect on my future breakaway chances because of how deep I'd gone. So yeah, it just was felt pretty disappointing. But I also felt kind of bad looking back for Woods, because it felt like a lot of people were looked at Woods as like the villain on that day, but he really deserved to win more than pretty much anybody. Like he had been chasing it for so long, and you know, he's an older rider now, if you could say that. So I felt pretty actually happy that he got his first win that day.
Very nice of you to say.
He's a nice guy also, so
Now
I'm,
in November,
we're
months after the race.
exactly. I
So
couldn't say
then,
it then.
yeah, no, I don't think you could have said it then. Then you managed to recover, stage 12. So only, another three stages after that, you again enter one of those absolutely crazy, bonkers, mental breakaway stages in Tour de France, where you're heading to Belleville on Beaujolais wine country, and we've got a situation where breakaway is trying to get away. Then all of a sudden, Vingegaard wants to get in the breakaway, and Pogacar's chasing him, and it was just again, as you explained, one of those days where you're doing, I can't even remember how long that went on for. It felt like about 90 minutes,
Two
2 hours.
hours.
Of
2 hours that
crazy,
day.
crazy
Yeah.
racing. So, how on earth did you manage to make the break on a stage like that when, as you said, you enter the race not in top form?
Yeah.
3, 4 days earlier, you've emptied the tank on another breakaway stage. How on earth are you still there making the breakaway on that day?
That day was all about, actually it really helped that day to not be on good form. I mean, you had to be on good enough form to be there, obviously. I think I wasn't in good form that tour, but I was still in, you know, good enough, I was in a good enough place to make those kind of breakaways, and my threshold was still quite high. So it's like I still had the ability to diesel and ride hard for a long time. It was really the explosiveness and like the VO2 stuff that I was lacking. So that day really helped, actually. When the break takes that long to go, it really helps to be on the limit at like the beginning of it, because you just don't even try to go in the early moves, right? So like I was letting all my teammates try for like the first hour that day, to get in those moves. And I think I'd been in one or two, but it was like I after, you know, for me the rule is like after it, if it takes more than 30 minutes, it's usually going to take 90. That's like the way that I see it in the tour is like if everyone's fighting for a 30, then it's not going to go for another hour because everyone's going to fight. And like once you know it's going to be a huge fight, then everyone starts fight, like even more guys jump in and start fighting. So it was one of those days where you just have to I just kind of gambled and waited for a long time. And you know, you're just kind of sitting there in the wheels, and obviously you're going really hard. Like you're going up these climbs at we're doing these climbs at we're going super hard at six watts per kilo or more. And you're kind of just, you know, banking on the guys that have been trying for a while, they're gonna get tired and eventually stop trying. And that's kind of what happened is like eventually I went with I think I went with Jan on a down Jan and Amador, we went on a downhill. So it's like it was one of those moments where like enough guys had just kind of like sat up and everyone's just kind of okay, we'll let that group go. And we bridged on a downhill. And then eventually I think like Pino and some more guys came on the next climb. But it wasn't even the case of like that day, it wasn't even the case of the group like actually went. It was just that the group behind kind of made a peace treaty and just said like, look, we've done this for long enough, and if we do this any longer, no one's gonna have teammates left, right? Like it's literally just gonna be Vingegaard, Pogacar, and you know a few other guys in a group, and nobody wants that situation, right? Like nobody wants a completely uncontrolled situation where anything can happen. So they all kind of sat up and we went, and yeah, thankfully on that day, I mean, I actually entered relatively fresh, I felt like, compared to most guys. So I had kind of a leg up, but still just didn't work out that day either.
Third place, like you're topping up, you're ticking over the top fives at Tour de France. What did we say? Three previous year, this year another two, so five top fives now.
Yeah.
You stepped off the bike after stage 15. Remind me, why was that?
Yeah, I tore my hamstring. So on stage,
Yeah.
yeah, I think it must have been stage 15 was the crash with a spectator
Yeah,
in Van
it wasn't.
Hooydonk.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I crashed on the left-hand side into some barriers, and my foot just like last, I've torn each hamstring once now, and my left side was in the crosswinds in Paris last year. And it was just because like my foot, it's like one, it's these crashes that happen so quickly that you have a tough time reacting. And so my foot basically stays in the pedal on one side, and I get like my bike goes a certain direction where it tweaks my leg and it really strains my hamstring. That's kind of what happened both times. And so yeah, I tore the same exact spot on my other side, on the hamstring, like right behind my knee and right at the junction where it kind of turns into tendon at the knee. And yeah, I on the rest day got a scan and we saw the tear, and it was like a pretty low level tear compared to the one at Paris-Nice. Knew from doing Paris-Nice and having raced through it and continued, you know, pushing on it, that it literally just gets wider every time you fire the hamstring, right? Because you're just stretching a tear that's going to get wider and wider. So I didn't really want it to be like a season-ending thing, and also I knew that with that tear and how much pain it is, that it just I would have no chance of winning a stage anymore in the tour, and we had no GC guy left, and there was no point in me continuing and suffering through it. So yeah, after the rest day, I didn't start the TT, and I just went home and went back to the US for a while, which was a break I needed at that point because I was pretty mentally in a hole.
How hard is it to try and peak again after Tour de France? The problem is, right, for cycling fans, we see the very best. Okay, we see Pogacar, guys like Simon Yates, who some might even say isn't the very best, but he's an incredible bike rider. We see these guys able after Tour de France to go again. You as a young rider, how hard is it to do that?
Yeah, it hasn't worked out now 2 years in a row. I think a lot of it, to be honest with you, is mental. And it's not like What I mean by mental is that it's really hard to refocus again and get back to a place where you're paying attention to all the details and training correctly and eating correctly and just living like a monk again after the tour, because by the time you get to the tour, I mean, both years I'd done that for so long and so much of the year that, the tour is such a highlight and like the team puts so much emphasis on it, and obviously the whole rest of the world does too. It's the biggest bike race by far and there's so much emphasis on it that you have this like mental, the tour is over and you just like have a drop mentally where it's like, well, why am I going to go back to altitude now and lose weight again? And it's like it just doesn't feel worth it at all after like trying to work hard to peak for a tour of Luxembourg after trying to win a stage of the tour. Just like doesn't compute in your brain, right? And it's nothing against Tour of Luxembourg or any small race. There's tons of really good small races, but it's just a mental thing where you have to, yeah, just trying to go back and put that level of effort into to work. Working so hard after the tour is a really tough thing. I've never nailed it. I mean, this year was probably even worse than last year, where I just kind of, in some ways, just never, I just mailed it in afterwards a little bit and tried to get through the rest of the season.
The rest of the season, you end up finishing in China just a couple of weeks ago. So I know some riders like to keep going until China because they struggle to train, they struggle to get the motivation to go out training. Also, you maintain a relatively high level, so you don't dip too much when you have your holiday. What was your thinking behind riding all the way through to mid-October?
It was more just obligation than anything, to be honest with you. Yeah, I was told I had to do it, and it was also fine. Yeah, that is a true thing where you want to get, yeah, there are a certain amount of race days you want in a season, or you want to finish at a certain time so that you can have a true break and take some time off the bike without stressing too much. So yeah, I was, I went and it wasn't so bad. It was a fine experience, and yeah, I tried to give my best for the team and get them some UCI points while I still could.
Okay, so next year, so as everybody knows, you're moving to Jumbo Visma. Talk to me about that. So rather unfairly, I think you have received some criticism. Now, I don't know if the criticism is from anybody who really has a valid opinion on this, but some people seem to think you're giving up your own personal ambition, which I think is not true. Joining the best team in the world seems a logical decision for me. What was your thought process in joining Jumbo Visma?
Yeah, really just that. Yeah, I think, well, a few things. I think I'm at a point where I'm still, I'm still a young rider and considered a young rider, and teams and people look at me as if I still have, and I also hope that I still have, margin to get better and room to grow, and hopefully that there's still space for my power numbers to come up and I can still become a better rider. So I'm at the point where I would like to go to a place where I know that, I can do that, and where I can get the most out of myself when I still have that, when I have that chance. So yeah, for me, I was from the outset, at the beginning of the year, I asked my agents basically to try to seek out the best possible performance scenario that I can be in, right? So go to a team where I can have the, where you can tell that the riders that go there, they sign there and they usually get better. That's kind of what you want out of a team. And so yeah, that's what I asked my agents for. And for me, once I was approached by Jumbo, it was a pretty clear choice. I felt like it's a team where every single rider almost that signs there from another team, they usually, with almost certainty they get better. And it's just a place that I'm pretty confident, and also just having talked with them, our mindsets and views on cycling matched so well that it felt like almost a no-brainer for me to go there. So yeah, I understand the criticism of people saying that, and it's valid. I think in cycling in general, you want to see riders spread across teams so that you have exciting racing, and that's a totally valid thing. So people get upset when they see when they see teams get stronger, when they see guys sign for different teams. But I'm just trying to look out for myself, and I'm also at a maybe later in my career would be a point where once I kind of find my best level, it'd be a time where I could go and just focus on a place where I can get my best opportunities. But I'm still a young rider, and there's still quite a bit I can learn. Like, there's still a lot I'm sure I don't know about cycling, and they can teach me at Yumbo, so that's why I wanted to go there.
And does the move mean a change of coach?
Yeah, for sure. Nowadays in cycling, pretty much everyone has in-house coaching. So yeah, actually just today, like 2 hours ago, had a call for the first time with my new coach. So yeah.
Which one of the gurus at Jumbo is taking over your coaching?
His name's Tim Heerskerk. He's Jonas's coach, and yeah, he seems like a really good guy. He's Dutch, and yeah, we had a good call.
So what I'm looking forward to is your potential TT improvement. So you've spent a lot of your own money this season and previous seasons trying to fund altitude camps, kit for TT races and stuff like that, which you won't hopefully have to do anymore. I think you're very good in classics, you're very good at climbing. For me, the TT in Roman Day was a kind of a glimpse at what is possible. Do you think that's maybe where you can see the biggest improvement?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I'm interested to see what's even possible, because I think the challenge for me in TTs is actually, well, I don't know the percentage of what it is, but there's two problems. It could be material, or it could be my body shape. And I think my body shape is pretty, you can tell by taking one look at me on a bike, is that I have a pretty unaerodynamic body shape. I have really wide shoulders and narrow hips, so I kind of go the opposite direction of what you want. Guys usually with narrow shoulders and wide hips have a really fast position, and so yeah, I've tried my best kind of to work around that by getting I got special extensions this year that were able to kind of put my hands at an angle that pulled my shoulders in, and there's various things you can do. And then also, it's really hard to say with certainty if the material at Yumbo is going to be faster, but I'm hoping that it is, and I can make a step in that department. And I know that they do really thorough testing anyway, and we can get my body shape to at least the point where it's the most optimized possible. So you're right, I think that's probably the area where I could make the biggest jump if we decide to go that route. So I'm hoping to know a little bit more in December once they kind of make some decisions. I know that they're in that process now of kind of figuring out, yeah, what direction they want to go with me.
I was going to say, because it feels like you're almost at a crossroads in your career. We've spoken for a couple of seasons about the type of rider you can become, classics rider, GC rider, and your performances this year have almost made that almost like a worse problem to solve, because you did so well in E3, you did so well at Flanders, but you won Oman, you were second in Romandy, so it really feels like a moment where your team have to decide. I think I have a hunch that it might be the GC route that it's taken, but with potentially racing Tour of Flanders as well. The team have made it very clear they want to win that race, probably without. And without Nathan van Hooydonk this season, they're kind of missing a really big kind of rider. What's your hunch? What do you think?
I think you're probably right. To be honest, I go both ways. I don't really know. I don't really know which way they would lean, but I'm pretty convinced now that just having seen what other riders can do now, I think it's pretty possible that they try and do both. I think the biggest two things, the two variables that you kind of need to control are the weight and the like your threshold and lactate clearance abilities, which kind of changes how explosive or how efficient you are. So I think they're quite good at managing those things and kind of shifting them throughout the season. So I'm hoping that they allow me to do both still, at least to a certain degree. I might have a focus on one or the other, which I'm totally fine with either way. But I'm hoping that, yeah, like you said, I'm still able to do some of the harder classics and be part of that group, because also from the outside, it seems like a really nice dynamic to be in when you're on such a strong team in those kind of races, because you can kind of play the game and it just seems a bit more fun than being on my own kind of in the classics and just wasting energy like I did at E3. So yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to seeing which way they push me.
So you started this season as a rider with something to prove. You won your first race. You were second in Romandy. You again had a couple of top fives in Tour de France. Are you happy with what you've achieved this season?
I am. I definitely am. No question. Yeah, I think really my only clear, objective was to win a bike race, and I got that out of the way pretty quick. So then I made bigger objectives and things that I didn't quite meet, but I think in general I can be super happy with the steps I took, and especially being on a contract year, I was pretty motivated to get to a better team and just yeah. Prove myself that I belong in a team like Jumbo. And so both of those things went well and I was able to meet those objectives. So it's really, I think I can say, yeah, the year went super well. Like, yeah, almost perfectly.
And how do you start 2024? What type of
In a
rider are you?
similar, yeah, I think now it's going to be about seeing, if I can win a bigger race, I think, or yeah, if I even have that chance. But I think it'll be about proving myself within the team structure, because it'll be my first year on a 3-year contract. And so I think it'll be about, yeah, proving myself again to the team. I mean, really, cycling, the proving yourself aspect never really ends. I think even guys you see that have won the tour 5 times, like Chris Froome, have to still go out there and prove themselves in races. So, I think that never really stops. But yeah, I think I can hope to kind of show the team that I'm valuable and also help the team. I hope to really, one of my big goals will be to make the tour team and help Jonas. So yeah, I really want to try to prove in the spring that I'm capable of doing that.
Well, Matthew, thank you for your time. Wishing you a nice rest over the Christmas period and a fantastic 2024.
Thank you, David. Thanks for the yeah, good questions and always good banter.
Spectacular diagnostics. Full kumite, accumulate pace. First razor blade for the gate, we're moving weight to win the weight. Wise ways, precise aim. Trying to rhyme like this might lead your mind strain. The times change, flight delay, light haze. Thoughts looking like they foundation might cave. The look in my eyes resemble the ice age. The clocks of the route, the rent park is way park waves. Like moves on, move raw. Involuntarily eat your full paw. Feel like a painter who can't do wrong. Fallatio from lazy do fall to cocaine. But brought a broad brain with all game, you slow change. She threw like a solid grand, probably 10. We push it in the hallway, on guard always.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, not daddy. Oh, yeah. I feel like. Should be fossilized in amber. Wise commander, fuck all the lies and slanders. When it come to ill niggas, you sound like the standard. Feathers and quillers, I write the standards. Cobra, going through my cobra. Tengo dinero, pero no me sobra. You want the flake of the boulder, then I'm introducing the baking soda. Anthony Yoda Palace, so we go to some blowing hazy circles in Minnesota. Buffaloes in their barrio, drama with Disco King Mario. Shotty blow in the hands of the Sicario. I reload the pill off without watching his body fold. Porky Yasa, the Mighty Gone. Rainbow headband, Sylvester Stallone, skull and bone, herring bone, wishbone. Went out for the trophy and brought the shit home. Blowing loud Indo, chop the rock to 16-bit Super Nintendo. The cream rises in a crescendo, nigga. Well, now your daddy kicking at, you know what I mean? Jump off the motherfucking cliff live out the district, shit, my nigga. Word.